This is Eleanor Albert. Today is September 26th, 2008, and I am interviewing Alexandra Dove, who is a research professor at McCardle Lab, currently emeritus.
Emerita.
Emerita, thank you, that's good. Could you tell us a little bit about your early life, where you were born and where you went to school?
Yes, I was born in New York City at the Beth Israel Hospital in Manhattan. We lived in Queens, in Sunnyside, until I was 10. So I was born in 1933, March 27th. And my father was at the Rockefeller Institute at that time, before it became a university. He was a physical chemist. In fact, almost everybody in my family seemed to be a physical chemist. My mother had a master's degree in physical chemistry. I have a brother who became a physical chemist. I have an uncle who had an uncle who was a physical chemist. And so everybody seemed to, it was a given that I would go on to college and graduate school. It was not a question. So we moved into Manhattan when I was 10 and lived right near Columbia University. I went entirely to the New York public schools. I had thought, it had been thought that I would go to music and art, the High School of Music and Art. But in fact, at the last minute, I wasn't accepted. And so I went to George Washington High School in the Bronx, where, by the way, Henry Kissinger and,
Alan Greenspan.
No, I don't know about Alan Greenspan. No, I'll think of it later. There was another well-known New York person.
Oh.
Anyway, then I went to Hunter College, where I majored in chemistry. And I graduated in 1954 and decided I did want to go to graduate school, but I didn't know in what area. I was thinking maybe biochemistry. But I decided to get a job and work for a year first. So I went to Boston. I wanted to get, I'd lived at home throughout college and wanted to get out onto my own. And I had a couple of friends. I used to spend summers in Woods Hole when I was in college. I had various jobs at the MBL, and I would sit in on some of the courses, summer courses in marine biology. Anyway, I had a couple of friends I had made, two young women who we had agreed to live together, and we were looking for a place in Cambridge, an apartment to share. And in fact, through my parents, we found out about an apartment that a well-known yeast geneticist named Frusci, who was originally, I think, from Poland, but actually was in France. Anyway, he, on a sabbatical year at Harvard, he and his wife had this apartment, and we took it over, my two friends and I. So I worked for, I was just incredibly fortunate to get a job in the pharmacology department at the medical school, at Harvard Medical School, through a fluke. I had a friend who was a graduate student there. She was the daughter of friends of the family. And I met her for lunch one day, and her professor came in and joined us, and we talked, and he asked me what I was doing, and I essentially was kind of making fun of myself that I was looking for a job for just 1 year because I was going to go to graduate school. And I didn't even want to work full-time. I wanted to work part-time because I needed to take some courses before starting graduate school. And anyway, at the end of this lunch, he said, well, stop by my office and I may have something for you. And he offered me a job, which was incredible. He treated me like a graduate student, really. He gave me a project to work on and said, go to the library. I'll give you a couple of names. Go to the library and read. And that's what I did. And the names he gave were very well-known names. Jacques Monod was one of them. And Lederberg was another one. And so I began reading their papers, which I found fascinating. I had never read anything like that when I was an undergrad. Anyway, so I ended up spending this year and learned a great deal and decided that I was going to, if possible, stay at Harvard. And there was a program called Medical Sciences. It was a new program started in 55, or no, I guess in 54 or 53 perhaps. Anyway, it was to provide the first year of medical school for certain selected students, plus a master's program for graduate students. And there were about 20 students in the class, each class. So roughly 10 medical students, 10 graduate students. And it was pretty much a survey course of all of the medical sciences. And it wasn't so much, the point wasn't so much that you would learn a lot of specifics and details, but you would come away from this course being able to read the literature in any one of a number of medical science fields so that you could educate yourself, basically.
Now, what was the lab like that you worked in, or were you mostly at the library at that time?
No, it was a lab. It wasn't a very large lab in the pharmacology department. It had, there were just one or two graduate students and a couple of technicians, and I think one or two undergrads as helpers. And the project was to try to select mutants that were resistant to certain drugs and then study the mechanism of resistance. That was the general scheme.
So by the end of the year, how far?
Well, by the end of the year, actually, I didn't get very far, but I learned a lot. So after my 1 year in this medical sciences program, I didn't bother to pay for the master's degree. You had to pay, I forget exactly what it was, $100 or something, $75 maybe. I don't remember. And I decided it was irrelevant because I was going to get a PhD anyway. So I didn't bother. But at that time, I had been given a scholarship actually for this medical sciences, and then it defrayed basically my tuition, and my parents supported my living. And then I got a NIH fellowship. From then on, I had NIH fellowships because this was the just post-Sputnik era, and the government was really wanting to train scientists.
Now, did you find, as a woman, that you were in a minority in your studies there? Or?
Yes, I was a minority. I mean, there were some others, but yeah, women were minorities. But I didn't feel that I was discriminated against, actually. I mean, I got funded, and I was able to do all the work I wanted to do. So in that sense, I didn't feel hampered.
Well, maybe minority is the wrong word. I guess I was trying to find out whether you were a very small, women were a very small proportion.
Well, I can tell you, in the particular lab where I ended up, there was one other woman graduate student. It wasn't a huge lab. I think there were a total of maybe three male and just two female. It wasn't. Now, our professor was certainly not anti-female. He was not. This was a man named Boris Magasanik. This was in the Department of Bacteriology and Immunology where I ended up. And he was very supportive of women in science.
So you finished your year and then
in medical sciences,
and then you moved into...
I asked if I told him I would like this professor. He had given some lectures mm-hmm. in the course of this year, and I was really very interested in his approach. And from the reading I had done while I worked for a year, I knew that working with bacteria was something I really wanted to do. That this was, you know, this was sort of the beginning of molecular biology. It was just pre-molecular biology. So it was called microbial physiology. Okay. And genetics was becoming a part of it.
Well, would you say that you were pretty set on your what you were going to do, and you didn't have any period of wondering?
Well, when I graduated from college, I was very uncertain uh-huh. and worried. It seemed to me that almost everybody knew what they wanted to do, and I didn't. Mm-hmm. And it was once I got landed in this fortunate job that a world opened up to me that I hadn't known anything about and that I found really interesting.
Now, did you have siblings who...
I have a brother who also got a degree in his degree was in what he called geochemistry. So he got a piece of the moon, for example, as a graduate student to analyze.
I see.
He was at Princeton for graduate work.
Well, then, what was your thesis when you did your PhD?
Well, it was on the role of histidine in the metabolism of adenine. It's the other way around. The role of adenine in the metabolism of histidine. And this was a period when people were beginning to understand things about something about control mechanisms, that it was known, for example, that bacteria, if you grew them in liquid culture, you could grow them, for example, E. coli, you could grow it in what was called a minimal medium, in which it just was given a source of nitrogen, a source of energy like glucose and various salts, and that was it. And it would grow quite happily. You could also grow it, and it would then make all of its amino acids and other metabolites that it needed. But if you grew it in a complex medium, a broth medium, again, it would grow more rapidly, and it would stop making its own metabolites and use those that were given. Mm. And so then the question was, how does that work?
So was that a question that you continued exploring after your PhD?
No, actually not. I got interested in bacterial viruses called bacteriophage. So when I finished my doctorate, I applied for postdoctoral fellowships, and I got a 2-year fellowship and spent the first year in Denmark, in Copenhagen. My intent was to learn more genetics, and it was to be the lab of somebody in whose field was yeast genetics. Unfortunately, he had a heart attack just about the time I was going, and so I ended up in the same institute but in a different lab dealing more with bacteria. And again, that was a man named Ole Møller, who was interested in control mechanisms also. And then I had a second year set up in England, in Cambridge, in the lab of Sidney Brenner, who is a genius of, and knows about everything. He knows all kinds of things.
So that they were successful years from your point of view?
Yes, yes. And in fact, that's where Bill and I met in Brenner's lab. We shared a lab. That's how we met each other.
I see.
So.
And then after your 2 years of postdoc?
Well, after the 2 years of postdoc, I actually got a job in Paris at an institute called Institut Biologique Physico-Chimique, physical chemistry again, with a person named François Gros, who again was in this same era of early molecular biology and microbial physiology and genetics. So I spent a year there.
So approximately now, what year are we?
So
I
finished my doctorate in 1960. So I went abroad in November of 1960, spent a year in Denmark, and I actually spent a year and a half in Cambridge. I wanted to finish a project I was working on there, and they had funds that they supported me for half the year. And then I went for another full year to Paris.
And so that was a job, basically, or was it?
Yes,
more
that
training?
Was a job. It was what a so-called CNRS appointment. This is the French equivalent of NIH.
I see.
And Bill always likes to tell this story that those are tenured positions. So once you have one of these, you're really set for life, except that I resigned mine in order to come back and marry Bill.
So you left after 1 year?
I left after 1 year, and then I got another fellowship. Bill was at Stanford by then, doing his postdoc, and I got another postdoctoral fellowship in a different department at Stanford, where we spent a year.
And what department was that?
It was biophysics.
And then does that bring you to the University of Wisconsin?
Then, yes. So we arrived in Madison in beginning of April in 1965. Right. And I remember that there was still snow on the ground. A little bit, not a lot.
Well, had you visited?
We did visit, yes. So we were married in June of 64. And on our way to Stanford, we stopped in Madison, where Bill had interviewed while I was still in Europe and had accepted the job. And so we came to kind of, because I had never been here. And so we came to see Madison and look into what housing there might be available and so on.
Well, what made you decide to come to Madison? You're both from the East Coast.
Right. Well, Bill had interviewed at various places on the East Coast, Harvard included, but he liked the sense here. That first of all, at McArdle, because it's a medical school department, but really had no teaching requirement. It was an option, but not a requirement. And Bill was really keen to do his research. He wanted some teaching, but he didn't want to be loaded down with heavy courses.
Right. But how about from your point of view? Did you have a...
Well, I actually didn't think I was going to like Madison. Having grown up in New York, I'd never heard anything good about the Midwest. I had the New Yorker's view that there's this wasteland between New York and California. And so I thought, well, maybe we'll just stay a year or two and then go to the East Coast.
I see.
But having gotten here, in fact, I turned out to like it very much. I mean, it's a wonderful place, I think, for doing one's work and for raising a family. Its life is easier, much easier than in the big cities. You do need a good coat and boots and so on. But as one of our actually Norwegian friends said to me once, There's no such thing as bad weather. There's just bad equipment.
Ah, that's a good way to put it.
And so I like the seasons, actually. That was something I missed in California, was the seasons.
And did you settle into a job here pretty quickly? Or
well,
not?
I did. I got yet another fellowship. And was officially a postdoc with Harold Rush, who was then the director of McArdle, and whose interest was working on an organism called a slime mold, Physarum polycephalum, which is an interesting organism in the sense that it can be a single cell the size of a pizza with many, many, many nuclei, all of which are dividing in unison, pretty much. And so there are certain kinds of regulatory studies that could be done with this organism that couldn't be done so easily with bacteria, for example. And so Bill was at that time working on a bacterial virus called Lambda, and he had worked on that actually in Cambridge. And I had been working on a different kind of bacterial virus, which I was interested in, but anyway, this other opportunity came up. And then we started having a family, and so we had three children in 3.5 years. Our oldest was born in April of 66, so just a little about a year after we got here. And because we had 3 and 3.5 years, I stayed at home. I didn't work in the lab at all for about 7 years until our daughter was ready for preschool and kindergarten. Then I went back first part-time helping Bill do some editorial work. He was an editor of the Journal of Molecular Biology at that time. So I was working just 10 to 15 hours a week doing editorial work, and then got a job it's the Department of Biophysics, again working on frog vision.
And that, was that at
with
McCarr?
Derek? No, Derek Bounds, who is okay. Now retired, but in zoology.
So that was after you had been home for 7 years?
After I'd been home for 7 years. So I was really sort of starting over. And Derek was interested in having some biochemistry done on these ice frog retinas, preparations of frog retinas. And so I spent a year, or maybe it was a year, a little over a year, in his lab. And then we did a sabbatical year back in Paris. I had been sort of wondering, have I fallen asleep in Madison? Life is so comfortable here. Let's go to a big city again and see. So Bill got a Guggenheim, and we spent a year. And that's where I began working with the mouse, because he was in the lab of Francois Jacob, who had been working with bacterial viruses and bacteria when he got his Nobel Prize, but then wanted to change directions and started working with the mouse. So I became a hands-on mouse person.
So your children were just going to the French school?
So we put our children in the French school. Our daughter, the youngest, was in the equivalent of first grade. And actually, they all started in first grade because they didn't speak the language. Mm-hmm. But it was a public school, and it was just really around the corner from where we lived. And it was hard on them at first, but they learned an enormous amount.
How did you feel about your taking that 7-year nap, as it's called nowadays?
Yes. Well, I think had it not been for the fact that Bill was my husband and an active scientist, it would have been even harder to get back. It was hard enough to get back because, you know, so much happened in that 7-year period that, I mean, I can remember one story that when we were in France, because I had lived in France for a year and I had studied French in school throughout high school and even in college for a couple of years. So I knew French fairly well. So there were these so-called reunions. They were group meetings, but they were of a whole big group, several groups together, and it was all conducted in French. And Bill had never studied French. He had studied Latin and Greek in school. So we sat together, and he had picked up a little French, but he would lean over to me and say, "What did he say?" And I would translate and tell him what he said, and then I would say, "What did he mean?"
So,
because a lot of the terminology had changed, and you know, there was a lot that had happened during my Rip Van Winkle nap.
Yeah. Well, to jump ahead a little bit, since we're on the subject, things are quite different now with women going to work while their children are small. What are your feelings about that? And I mean, how have you experienced it in the lab with the younger people?
Yes, well, it's true that there was a graduate student who had a child who, while she was still doing work, and she would be pumping. We had a little culture room, cell culture room, and she would go with a little note on the door, pumping, don't come in, and freezing milk and so on. And it is different. It's totally different. Of course, there are daycare centers now. Our daughter, who has two children, a three and a half year old and a 9-month old, is working full time now. And so the older one is in the Preschool of the Arts, which is a wonderful program. And that has the potential. You can bring a child there at 7:30 in the morning and pick them up at 5:30 in the afternoon. So that just wasn't so readily available here. Although in France, when we were there, in fact, there were, they called them creche for working parents, because to live in Paris, you needed 2 salaries, even back in the 60s, whereas to live here, 1 salary was sufficient.
Well then, would you say that you think it's a change for the better, or just a change?
I think it's totally different. And
it's different.
I think mothers, maybe some of them do feel guilty that they're not spending all day with their children. And I was talking with a friend recently, with Hildy actually, recently about this, that the mothers today seem defensive if somebody criticizes their child,
mm-hmm.
Or if there's a behavioral issue. There's this don't touch my child outlook, which I wonder if that is in some way, if that includes some sort of guilt,
yeah.
Feeling or feeling of being, you know, that you really wanted, that mother really would like to be there all the time.
Yeah.
But it's so variable, I found. I didn't want to work initially. But after about 7 years, I began to feel that, you know, I had given what I had to offer.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to turn my children loose,
right.
but so I was just so fortunate that I could go back in stages. I could go back first very short times, and then later. By the time our daughter was in high school, I was working full time. But up until then, it wasn't. It was first 25%, 50%. And so on, 3/4. You know, I was so lucky.
Mm-hmm.
I was given a lot.
Did you keep up with your field while you were home?
I couldn't. I was all of my energy. Yeah. But Bill would tell me, you know, he would talk to me about it, and I could ask him to explain what is this and what does that,
yeah.
what does that mean, and so on.
So you started back with Derek Bounds, and then
right.
where did you go?
And then we spent the sabbatical year
in
France, and then I felt that really the interest of the Bounds Lab was neurophysiology. And I was not comfortable with neurophysiology. My whole outlook is more of genetics. And I sort of felt as almost as if I was on a desert island surrounded by water, and I couldn't set foot in the water. So I decided that really that wasn't going to work out very well, and so I ended up getting a position in Bill's lab.
In McArdle.
In McArdle, yeah. In Bill's lab specifically.
So that was in the 70s then?
That was, we came back in 76, so that was in the fall of 76. Right.
So you were here during upheaval, student upheaval.
Yes, we were, but I was working at, I was at home.
You were at
yes,
home.
Our son, our oldest son was in the lab school on campus. So he was 3 and a half and 4. And I remember him being really upset. He loved the school. And he was so upset when they had to cancel school sometimes because of some of the student riots. They just felt it wasn't safe.
Mm-hmm. So was, as far as you could tell, was McArdle affected by this?
No, not significantly, no. I think, I mean, there were meetings that I went to, people would get together to discuss issues ranging from graduate students being unionized
yeah.
to, you know, of course, the war. Almost everybody I knew was anti-war. And then issues of what role students should have in the administration and so on. It was all that was bound up together. And we saw the same, we have, you know, continued to have friends in Paris, and they were going through something very similar with student riots and students wanting a role in the university. So
I think it's interesting to think about whether, as a result of all that upheaval, the university had a different feel to it as opposed to when you first came.
Well, I think it did. It was maybe more subtle than obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But medical schools were, I think, traditionally rather rigid. And administrators, the chair was the sole, was the major authority.
Mm-hmm.
And I think things, I mean, Harold Rush, who was the founder of McArdle, stepped down from McArdle and went to the hospital and set up the cancer center. He started that cancer
mm-hmm.
center there. So he was a person who excelled in those kinds of foundings, and he was very good at getting funding. He was also very careful not to overspend and so on. So it was, he was a not maybe quite a typical administrator,
mm-hmm.
but still he ran the show.
Well, what about faculty governance? With that?
Yeah, well, so now I think a lot of departments now have rotating chairs rather than one chair who has his career or maybe gets stolen away
right.
to become the chair at some other prestigious place. But
so when you came back to McArdle, who was the director at that time?
So Henry Pitot took over Henry Pito and Betty Miller co-chaired, in a sense. I mean, Henry was the had the title, but Betty Miller was the vice chair, or maybe assistant. I can't remember whether she was the assistant chair or not, but she was every bit as much a presence as Henry. Mm-hmm. And I think, but Henry, they worked out well, because if you're doing research at the same time that you're being a chair, I'm sure you know this better than many people, it's very difficult, and you need somebody
to take care of the details.
Right.
So overall, have you seen any substantive changes in the way things are run?
Well, of course, the ratio of graduate students to female to male has changed dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
But now because funding is so difficult, a lot of people are planning to go into industry, not planning to become researchers at universities, unless, of course, there are some special circumstances. But it's much more difficult now to be funded than it was when I was being trained, and my training went on a very long time, you might say.
Well, in light of that, does the lab suffer from, or does the whole research enterprise suffer from people not hanging in there, basically? Or?
Well, I think, you know, it's still a very exciting field, because so much is happening in terms of being able to intervene in illnesses that used to be a life sentence, mm-hmm. without doubt. And so there is the sense that nobody really knows where this will end, that it's still very exciting. So there's been a very long period in which the biological sciences and medical sciences have just flowered, and it's really mind-boggling.
Did you find the university supportive in terms of funds?
Well, I myself didn't apply for funds. I was paid on soft money from the time I entered Bill's lab.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've been, Bill's been lucky with being funded well. It gets more difficult,
mm-hmm.
every time he has to reapply. But, you know, I think his work has been very successful, so he's done well, and hopefully will continue to be funded. But
is it a problem in terms of getting graduate students there?
To some extent, yes. I mean, now, of course, as people get older, graduate students, I think, tend to shy away a little bit, because they wonder, you know, will I be able to finish under this person?
See, yeah.
You know, that's a component.
Mm-hmm.
But Bill has got one new graduate student who's just starting now, and potentially another one.
But how about the lab as a whole?
Well, the lab as a whole, I mean, there were some funding cuts that did impact. There were some people who, I mean, for example, I myself, I'm now 5% in Bill's lab. I'm a consultant in Bill's lab. I go to group meetings and I try to play the devil's advocate, you know, in this experiment or that experiment. I do try to critique,
mm-hmm.
and then I do some editorial work for when papers and grants are being written. And then I have an appointment, which I'm also 20% now for the department. I used to be a higher percentage in the department, but I chose to step down to 25% so I could help with our grandchildren.
I see.
So I sit on the McArdle Animal, there's an animal care committee in the McArdle, but then there's also, I'm a McArdle representative on the, what's called the IACUC committee for the medical school, the Animal mm-hmm. Care and Use Committee for the medical school.
So are those areas which interest you particularly?
Well, yeah, I find them interesting and very and essential. I mean, it's clearly, since over the period when I started working, one could do all kinds of things that are not acceptable today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is one way of addressing animal rights movements to really have close supervision and very clear rules as to what can be done and what requires veterinarian oversight mm-hmm. and so on. So I think it is the way, it's the way things have to be.
Would you say that what you're doing now is more administrative?
Yeah, yeah. It is more administrative.
And so right. Did you give up your research only when you
Yes, I sort of gradually wound mm-hmm. down, so to speak.
Do you miss it?
Well, I do. I like working with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's a time and place mm-hmm. for everything. And as I've become somewhat more arthritic, some of the things I used to do, I don't do. Wouldn't do as easily. I don't give up easily, so mm-hmm. I would continue, but a lot of the work has changed. The nature of the work has changed.
Is that a result of the use of computers and?
To some extent, yes. I mean, it's now. The nature of the work has to do entirely with studying colon cancer, and there are two models. There's a mouse model and a rat model. These are kindreds that carry a germline mutation. Excuse me, in a gene called APC, Adenomatous Polyposis Coli, which is mutated in certain familial colon cancer syndromes, and is also even in the spontaneous, the non-familial form, that gene is commonly mutated.
So and that's what's being studied primarily?
So yes, so in fact, the mouse model was isolated, oh golly, it's 20 years ago, a little more than 20 years ago now. And it was first discovered in a mutagenesis experiment. Mm-hmm. So we did a lot of mutagenesis in those days. And this was a animal who turned out to have a dominant anemia, which was eventually traced to multiple tumors throughout the intestinal tract and blood loss from the tumors. Although there could be more to it than that. I don't think that's ever been totally studied. But anyway, so the mouse model, which is called MIN, stands for multiple intestinal neoplasia, has been used all over the world to study colon mm-hmm. cancer, although the predominant tumor burden is in the small intestine, rather more rarely in the colon. And so it's not a perfect model. We know the mouse is not a human,
right.
So it's not too perfect. Surprising. But there was a directed attempt to get a rat line mutated in that same gene to see how the rat would behave. And indeed, the rat model, so there was such a mutant found, and the rat, the tumors are predominantly in the colon, and more rarely in the small intestine, which reflects that's exactly the case for the human. And one thing we know is very different between the mouse and the rat is the organization of chromosomes. The rat is more like the human in terms of having a small arm and a large arm with a centromere connecting the two, whereas in the mouse, all the centromeres are at one end of each chromosome, and there's only one arm. Now, whether that's, we don't know what the significance of that is yet, but that's under study, certainly.
That's under study. Well, you know, not to ask a leading question, but just because this comes up so much with people who've had a long-term career, how has your work been impacted by the sort of the revolution that computers has brought?
Yes, well, of course it makes data handling possible that wasn't practical before. Now it's possible to do colonoscopies on both the mouse and the rat, and virtual colonoscopies. Now those are computer, and that's huge in terms, because now it's possible to look at follow a particular tumor in the colon. It can be marked, for example, with India ink, and one can follow it longitudinally to ask whether some regimen of treatment, what kind of an impact it has. Before that, and that's all very new, before that capability, one had to do what are called cross-sectional studies. You'd have to look at a population of animals and say, okay, if you treat this group and you don't treat that group, what is the effect when you finally dissect them? So that requires many, many, many more animals and much more time.
Oh.
I mean, it's huge.
Was it hard to learn new methods?
Well, yeah, I've not actually done those treatments myself, but under the tutelage of the clinical cancer people. So Mark Reicheldorfer, who does colonoscopies, has been very helpful. And I'm blanking on his name, who does the virtual colonoscopies.
I don't know.
Picard, also. So there is a lot of collaboration going on between our group and those people.
The clinicians.
To try to get tissue, to try to get samples from the clinic. And of course that requires a certain, you know, all kinds of paperwork too.
Paperwork. Let's get to paperwork. The other aspect, I think, that's changed a lot in with computers and technology, is the support staff has sometimes disappeared.
Yes. Well, that's true. It certainly has been refined. So computers have made a vast difference in terms of writing papers. I mean, when I wrote my thesis, I had to submit an original and 7 carbon copies. And if one made a mistake on the, you know, whereas now it's trivial.
Yes, it's definite.
Plus communicating with people. I mean, the emails, you know, all there is a good and a bad side to that, of course, but rapid communication has been, you know, and looking at journals, I mean, the ability to screen journals for various keywords, for example, in titles of papers, that kind of thing.
And is that something that you were able to start to do yourself?
Well, I was doing that. I'm not involved in that right now, but yes.
I guess in terms of the structure of the lab, did affirmative action have any impact, or the desire of the university to attract diversity?
Well, we did try. I mean, there was one graduate student in the genetics program. Bill was very active. He was a trainer for the genetics grad students, and he's now given that up, and that's now taken over by Phil Anderson. But there was one a black graduate student from Connecticut who did spend a little time in our lab, and he, after being here for not too long, decided that he was going to leave because he didn't have enough companionship.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, if he wanted to date, it was very difficult. Now, I think it's changed over the last, now that was perhaps more than 5 years ago, maybe 6 years, 7 years ago. I don't remember precisely, but so that's changed.
That's diverse?
Not exactly.
Yeah.
No, the lab is not so diverse. We do have a Chinese postdoc who's now a scientist. We did have a Chinese graduate student, a Taiwanese actually, who's moved on. We've not had any people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And it just reflects the community.
The community, yeah. Well, we've been at this for an hour. Do you want to go on a little
while? Well, I don't know what you feel. I mean, you have to help me there.
Oh, well, if you're tired, we'll stop. Otherwise, we could go on for maybe 10 minutes.
Yeah, sure. Let's go on. I'm all right.
Okay. Did you yourself work with students?
Well, I did informally. I didn't participate in any courses, but I was the person who taught them how to handle mice and how to do certain techniques.
I was going to ask you if you've noticed any differences in students today as to when you started out.
Well, perhaps more mature, I would say. We only have one new graduate student now. And she is somebody who has worked in a lab she took a year off also and worked in a lab. So she came with that behind her there. But I think if I think back to when I was a graduate student and ask about that comparison, I think there's a vast difference in terms of the amount of experience the students today have had already as undergrads.
And why is that?
I think the nature of the class, of the coursework, it's just a lot of the techniques that were new since I finished my degree are given to undergrads now. You know, they all do that, and they read a lot more original papers than anybody did as an undergrad when I was there.
And do you feel that science is, you know, enough of an interest for students today?
I think so. I think so. Yeah. I think we hire a lot of undergrads to work in the lab, initially just doing routine things like sorting glassware and that kind of thing. And then the ones who show interest are often given projects. So some of them, they get Hilldale Awards too, so that they can carry out a whole project. And that's very valuable for the lab, but I think also certainly for the student.
Well, Looking back, would you have done anything differently, do you think?
I think I was so lucky. I was so fortunate. I guess, you know, I might have done some things differently. I think I would have made more effort not to live at home, to go to, you know, my undergraduate education cost $25 a year. My father, who still was at Rockefeller, you know, things, they didn't pay very well. My brother, who was a couple of, he's almost 3 years older than I, he went to Columbia, and there would just, there really wasn't enough money to support me at an Ivy school, Ivy League school, unless I had a scholarship. But I think I would have made more effort to do that. I think I was rather bored as an undergrad. I did take a course or two that I really enjoyed, analytical chemistry, and, you know, I enjoyed the lab parts, and embryology. I enjoyed, you know, certain things, and some of the literature I did enjoy too, I must say.
But I suppose that you don't really feel that it impacted on your later.
Well, as it turned out,
it didn't.
Right, but it could have. Had I not been, you know, I guess I just assumed I was going on. It was, if had I come from a different family, I might have just stopped after my bachelor's degree.
And would you say that there, in your work at UW, there were any obstacles that you had to face?
Well, I think there were. Initially, I was not as a, I was on the scientist track, so I started at as a, an assistant scientist and then was promoted to associate and so on. And I was not allowed to apply for my own grant initially. Now that's changed. That's not the case any longer. And by the time it changed, it was essentially too late for me. I wasn't, I'm not sure it would have, in the long run, made a big difference for me personally, but that's because of my connection with Bill.
I see.
Whereas somebody else could have been held back, would have been held back.
Because they wouldn't have been funded, basically.
Yes, and given the kind of freedom that I had, you know, to do, to go off in whatever direction I wanted to go, basically. So I started a project that wasn't on the agenda, Bill's agenda, which was to look for mouse models of human PKU. And we developed several models. But that was, I just found that interesting. And
but how was that funded then?
Well, it was funded by Bill.
By Bill's grant.
By Bill's grant.
Did you feel any problem in the lab because you were in kind of a privileged position?
Well, that did come up from time to time. Yes, that did come up. And I think Bill bent over backwards. I mean, I'm not saying more than he should have, but I think he was very careful to try. Now, you'd have to ask some of the other people in the lab, you know, whether he was successful in trying to keep that
objective.
Yes, right.
But you didn't feel personally any problem with
No, that. Again, I just feel that I was given, I was just very fortunate.
Well, that's a good thing to end on.
Yes. Okay.